loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the news of the day. First, President Trump is set to address by satellite Friday's March for Life, the annual anti-choice gathering that is gaining new ground under the Trump administration. Next, Acting Director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Mick Mulvaney, has requested no funding for the next quarter, stating that the Reserve Fund has $177.1 million, plenty to fund the agency, which expects $145 million in costs, essentially defunding the reserve. This is after his announcement on Tuesday that the agency will delay and revisit regulations on payday lending, a predatory system long understood to target the poor. Then, a little more than a year after then-President-elect Trump stood before cheering workers at a Carrier manufacturing plant in Indiana and promised to keep their Rust Belt jobs from moving to China, those same workers are feeling betrayed, as more than 1,500 were laid off, the final 200 just this week. And then members of the Catalonian parliament elected a separatist as speaker yesterday in their first meeting since the central government in Madrid dissolved the region's parliament. And finally, more than 120 prisoners took control of a French prison outside Paris in response to a demonstration by hundreds of prison guards a day earlier, during which the guards burned tires and wooden pallets in protest against a rise in inmate violence, insufficient staff, and a lack of resources to deal with dangerous jihadists they've been tasked with jailing. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the issue of abortion. President Trump is set to address by satellite Friday's March for Life, the annual anti-choice gathering that is gaining new ground under the Trump administration. We're joined from New York by Karina Garcia. She is a reproductive justice organizer. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So what do we make of a president, Karina, who is on record as saying that he is, quote, pro-choice in every respect? And now he's so anti-choice that he feels compelled to address the annual March for Life. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, the so-called Christian fundamentalist is a powerful interest group in the Republican Party, of course. And so he's just playing to the far right. He's, you know, he claims to speak about, who also claims to speak about morality. And then, you know, they pick the man who is the antithesis of morality, a complete pig accused of sexual assault, who flip-flops depending on whatever serves him at the moment, a racist, an opportunist, probably an adulterer. I mean, like, these are the things that they claim to care about. For his part, I think the only thing that matters to him is what's going to help him. So it's really a match made in heaven, a cynical, hypocritical, anti-woman group that just wants to find some politician who will implement their reactionary program. And on the other side, a cynical, hypocritical, bigoted, anti-woman opportunist politician who will say anything and do anything to mobilize support for himself.
Brian, there's something to that. This is a guy who still probably believes that he hasn't convinced everybody that he's right on their kinds of issues. And it seems like he wants to bend over backwards to yet again appeal to that base.
Yeah. Karina Garcia, let's talk about the sloganeering, because branding makes all the difference. You have the March for Life. It's so interesting that the Republican Party, the far right, the evangelical movement, all of these forces are saying that they're defending the rights of the unborn, that abortion is murder. Of course, they are the same forces that have been loath to pass the Children's Health Plan that gives 9 million poor children access, even minor access to health care. Maybe it will pass, maybe it won't in the coming months, but it's been put on hold spending for it. Let's just talk about the branding or the imprimatur of the so-called March for Life or the Right to Life movement. You're out in the field. You're organizing amongst poor working class women, young women. What do you say about these issues and about that kind of branding?
I mean, it's completely hypocritical, of course, like you mentioned. You know, they're the first ones to cut Medicaid. They're the first ones to say to cut WIC, to, you know, strip children and all people really of like any social services, of healthcare, of any kind of public assistance. It's just a complete distraction. It's a way to just shame and criminalize and humiliate and denigrate poor people. And it's not a new thing that they're doing, but it is something that like they pull out of their toolbox all the time. It's just another way to shame poor people, right? It's like there's millions of people who are without healthcare in this country. You know, millions of Latinas, I mean, like people who are dying from preventable diseases in the richest country in the world who don't have access to a doctor, let alone reproductive health care, who are working in this country and, you know, living with things that are preventable. You know, Latinas have twice as high a rate of cervical cancer, and that's a completely preventable disease and it can be controlled. But it's because people don't have access to health care. It's because people don't have access to transportation. So there's so many important social problems that exist that the government could be working on, that they should be working on. And instead, what they're doing is they're shaming women and working class people for their decisions, which are not really decisions, honestly, when you don't have any other options. You know, it's a big like myth, the idea that like they say that, oh, you know, people who are having abortions, it's like reckless teenagers, it's just these young women who are having lots of sex. And that's sort of like the image that they put out that can just, we can just all shame that woman. But the reality is that the majority of women who are having an abortion, 60% are mothers. And many of them have more than one child. So they're people who actually know what it is to have a child, who are raising children, and who are deciding for whatever reasons, their reasons, that they don't want to have another child, that they don't want to have a bigger family. And like they should be really focused on the things that the barriers, you know, to people having a family. You know, what do people think about when they want to have a family? They think about, well, do I have access? Do I have a job? Do I have access to healthcare? Do I have access to childcare? Can I take time off? And the answer to all those questions is no. That's what they should be focusing on. But that would be a harder problem. That would be something that actually forces them to deal with the system that they're benefiting from. The fact that millions of people are exploited and poor in this country, they don't want to solve those problems. Instead, they want to create an image of a reckless woman and put people's attention to, you know, shame and blame her.
Yeah. In fact, one of the most important people that activists ought to want to talk to is Paul Ryan, who's going to be one of the featured speakers at this march. So it's not like those of us on the pro-choice side are going to have any slack.
Yeah, and Paul Ryan is the same person who is trying to rip away people's healthcare benefits. He said exactly. He was dreaming in college when he was still doing a keg about getting rid of Medicaid and reforming Medicare. In other words, healthcare for the poor and for the elderly. I mean, what kind of creature is that? One thing, I'm looking at the Washington Post, Karina. It says the so-called life pro-life movement, the anti-abortion movement, the anti-woman, anti-rights movement. They say they have new momentum with President Trump, not because he's done anything in terms of fulfilling campaign promises. He can't make abortion illegal. But what's happening is that the Trump administration, through GOP appointees, is shifting federal policy in a very right-wing, anti-woman direction. This morning, the Department of Health and Human Services announced the creation of a new conscience and religious freedom division housed within the agency's civil rights office. Talk about the taking language and turning it upside down, which will be charged with ensuring that healthcare workers are allowed to opt out of any procedure to which they have a moral or religious objection, such as abortion or gender transition.
And it's interestingly to me, too, is that the numbers of people who participate in these marches varies wildly from year to year, depending on who's president. And the reason that's interesting to me is that when there are Republican presidents in office, the marches tend to be very small. In 2009, just a couple of weeks after Barack Obama's inauguration, 600,000 people participated in this march. Last year, immediately after Donald Trump's election and inauguration, 15,000 participated. So this may be a very small march. Now, with that said, there are also wild differences based on faith at the way people look at the issue of choice. I'm looking at an article in Vox right now that cites several different polls. is saying among Catholics, traditionally and historically abortion's biggest opponents, 53% believe abortion should be legal. 53% of Catholics, as do 55% of Black Protestants. It is only white evangelicals, out of all the different faiths, only white evangelicals who believe that abortion should be illegal.
And that was one of the points that Karina was making in the beginning of this. Karina, in our last 2 minutes or so, it appears that even though the government isn't trying to right now roll back or overturn Roe v. Wade, that might be coming. That's the court decision that gave women the right to abortion. There are so many restrictions at the state and local level that for big parts of the country and for millions, maybe tens of millions of women around the country, in a de facto sense, the right to an abortion has already been taken away. Talk about that if you would.
That's absolutely true. I mean, if people don't have access to healthcare, really, how can they have access to abortion services if their clinics are being shut down, you know, all over the state of Texas, their budgets are being cut? Then that means in real life, people don't have access. Even if the clinics do exist and there's an immigration checkpoint that's blocking them from getting there, or they can't take time off of work to go to a doctor. Like, there's so many barriers that exist for people to get healthcare, and reproductive healthcare is just become, you know, it's just even more harder to access. And so I think what we're seeing is, in fact, a lot of people, when as they're doing more polling about people's real opinions about abortion access, we're seeing that more people are for reproductive justice, that they're for people making their own decisions about healthcare, for them to have access, for abortion services to be affordable, that it's not, they might not identify as through the label pro-choice, but that doesn't mean that they're for politicians interfering in the decisions of women. When you ask them if they support women's decision making, then they do, and it's overwhelming actually in the Latino community. 89% of Latinos said they would support a friend or family member who's having an abortion, and their support for abortion access is similar. It's also a majority, so that's changed a lot. And I think you're absolutely right, John, that the evangelical right is actually a tiny little group. With a voice and, of course, the funding of billionaires that are making themselves to be something bigger than they really are.
And that's really it. It's all about the money at the end. We have to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Karina Garcia. She is a reproductive justice organizer. Thanks for joining us, Karina. In the meantime, please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We will be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Acting Director of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Mick Mulvaney, has requested no funding for the next quarter, stating that the Reserve Fund has $177.1 million in it, plenty to fund the agency, which expects $145 million in costs, essentially defunding the Reserve. This is after his announcement on Tuesday that the agency will delay and revisit regulations on payday lending, a predatory system long understood to target the poor. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He is the editor of thepolemicist.net. Jim, welcome back.
Hi.
Jim, are we seeing the beginning of the end of the CFPB?
Effectively, yes. I'm not sure how effective it was to begin with, but, you know, clearly this is a political decision to, you know, this guy was against the CPFB when he was in Congress. He spoke against it. He's changed the mission statement of it to say one of our missions is to find out what excess regulation there is and get rid of it. So it's part and parcel of the whole Republican attempt to do away with regulation, to, you know, make clear away the path for anybody who wants to make money from lending at usurious rates to poor people. And that's what it is. I mean, that's what payday lending was to begin with. There was some regulation of it. There was some regulation of it proposed. Actually, what he's done, I think, here is said he's going to put a pause on this for a few months in order to let there be hearings about it, et cetera. He's not exactly, I don't think, canceling the payday regulations. He's kind of putting them in a state where they can be put off for months and months and months. So, you know, it's a very serious political attack on the idea of regulation in general.
I wanted to ask you about this payday loan scheme, let's call it. You know, so many of these payday loan places, and they are predatory, but they prey oftentimes on young, inexperienced, immature military people, right? You see payday loan places just all over the place outside of U.S. military bases. You go down to North Carolina outside of Fort Bragg, and there are just dozens of them. And you would think that this would be a clash of ideologies within the Republican Party where, sure, you don't like regulation. They believe that regulation just in and of itself is a bad thing. But they're also so crazy supportive of the military. You would expect somebody from the right to step in and say, wait a minute, in this case, regulation is a good thing because we need to protect our soldiers from these predatory lenders. But that's not happening. Is there any other form of protection besides the CFPB that these young people who might be irresponsible with their money can turn to?
Well, you know, this is a substantive issue again. You're absolutely right. Very good to point that out. And it's the same thing with the private college industry, which makes
absolutely
billions on service members because they can get more money and give more loans to service members, get more money from the service members who have to take out more loans to come in, and they exploit service members terribly. But the substantive point of these guys, these people who are living in these communities and servicemen, aren't paid well. They have low-paying jobs essentially, and it's very hard to live. And this is part of the pitch for these for the conservative Republicans is, well, this is one of the only ways these people can get money when they need it. And that's true. So the fundamental point here is that you have masses of people, including many, many service people, who are living lives of weekly desperation and have to go out and chain themselves to debt slavery with either credit cards or payday lending services. What difference is it? Higher interest rate, but in order to keep their lives going every day. So until those service members stop buying the ideology of it's a good thing for me to have the important thing here is that I have the ability to go get $25 if I want, and start having the ideology that we need to have decent, secure jobs and lives that are decent, that support decent lives, then this is going to be we're nibbling at the edges here, and whether it's this guy, what's his name, okay,
Mulvaney,
or somebody else who reduces the interest rates from 400%, I think these loans are to 200% or whatever it is. You're nibbling at the edges of this social insecurity and desperation that's out there.
But
the Democrats are joining with the Republicans to deregulate the banks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, which just lead to more problems.
It's they're going to increase the risk, practical certainty, of financial failure like 2008, 2009. There are like 55 or 70 Democrats who are going to vote to remove the Dodd-Frank regulations from all but I think the top 10 banks or top 8 banks in the country. So you're going to have banks that have $50 billion of assets once again out there able to do crazy derivative transactions and financial speculation. So, this is not the general problem of the dominance of finance capital and the general tendency of people to have to live on debt and on credit cards and interest-paying debt is not being dealt with at all. And the payday lending thing I won't say it's small because I don't know how big it is, but it's a terrible part of it.
I want to explain to our listeners, too, when you said 200 or 300% interest, you weren't joking. I'm looking at an article in the Hill newspaper. And first, let me clarify, too, what this regulation does, the regulation that's now being rescinded by the Republicans. It says the rule imposes limits on how frequently a lender can offer, collect on, and extend high interest loans with deadlines of only a few weeks. Such loans are marketed toward customers with no other credit or financing options who need to cover emergency expenses. These loans come with interest rates as high as 400%. And borrowers who can't afford to pay by the deadline are often forced to renew the loan, spiking their total debt to the lender. And let's say something else too. Most of the people who take these loans at up to 400% interest are working people. They're the working poor, and they really do have no other options because the bigger banks won't allow them any other options. And then they end up spiraling into this life of debt that they can never claw their way out of. It was the CFPB that was supposed to help them break that cycle.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I have read that. That's where I got that 400% reduced to 200%. I figure.
Yeah.
But, you know, and these are desperate people, and they need it. And they, and the way HAP works, they take a small loan, $50.
Sure.
Okay, but you have to pay me in 2 weeks, $5. Well, that's a 10%. People say, oh, that's just $5. That's a 10% interest.
Yeah, it's a VIG. It's not even interest. It's a VIG.
Exactly. And if you keep doing it, then it becomes 400%. You know, you never pay off the principal. You just keep piling up new interest. We all know that with credit cards. But this starts out with small amounts, and it ends up being 100% a year. But this demonstrates the need for public financing and public banks. You know, as there used to be in Europe, there should be the post offices were banks. You could go in and get a loan. The whole financial and credit system should really be a public utility that is not just highly regulated, but is run in a nonprofit way by the government, which is there to put money into the economy and to people's hands who need it at a reasonable interest rate, you know, not for profit, not for speculation, such that whatever profits that come from it go back into the society. And it's there to help the economy and to help people move along, not to be a profit-making enterprise in itself. Once you have a situation where money becomes a primary profit-making enterprise, you're distorting what's even classical capitalists understood the capital economy to be, the capitalist economy to be. And it's very dangerous. On a small level, it's this 400% VIG on payday loans. At the large level, it's the billion-dollar derivatives.
Yeah. Jim, we have about a minute left. Can you tell us, is there a role or even the possibility for a role in some of these poorer communities for community banks or credit unions?
Absolutely. Community bank credit unions do a good job in these communities. You know, I know my wife's a member of a credit union out in Western Pennsylvania that, you know, you can get good, decent loans there. You can get good services. And, they do. There is a role for those. But, you know, those aren't the people who are controlling the legislation and the lobbying for regulations. So, and they're not the primary banks that are able to create money and make big loans. But that's the kind of thing that should be imitated and should be made public. There should be a public banking option, or the public should control the Fed credit and finance system. Got to read people like Ellen Brown, who's very good about this.
And it should be available nationally. It should be available in communities where there are poor and poor working people who need to take advantage of that. I'm sorry that we're out of time. We were joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
A little more than a year after then-President-elect Trump stood before cheering workers at a Carrier manufacturing plant in Indiana and promised to keep their Rust Belt jobs from moving to China, those same workers are feeling betrayed as more than 1,500 of them were laid off, the final 200 just this week. We're joined from New York by Pete Dolek. He's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro, who focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues. And he's also the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. Pete, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
Pete, was there any real chance that these manufacturing jobs were going to be saved? Or was this just campaign rhetoric?
It was campaign rhetoric. The idea that a billionaire who's made his entire career on screwing over working people was somehow going to be the savior of manufacturing jobs for working people, just doesn't pass the laugh last test. Unfortunately, of course, times are very difficult, especially for people in industrial areas of the Midwest. And there's enough people who heard what they wanted to hear and decided to take a chance on it. But it unfortunately hasn't worked out for them.
You know, I was born and raised in Western Pennsylvania in a Rust Belt town called Newcastle. And I remember the beginning of the end. I remember when I was in seventh grade, the Youngstown Sheet and Tube closed, and half the kids in my junior high school had their fathers thrown out of work all in the same day. That was in 1979. I remember kids crying in the hall at school because their dads had lost their job at the Sheet and Tube. The economy of Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio has never come back. And it just seems to me to be a fool's errand to go around the country and promise people that manufacturing is coming back to the Rust Belt. I mean, sure, we all would love to see manufacturing come back, but the world has changed. What is amazing to me, Pete, is that people believe that this can be turned around in a year, or that there are ideas out there that no previous president has thought of.
Again, I think people are just looking for some kind of easy answer. As you said, this has been going on for decades. I remember once being in Youngstown, Ohio, sometime in the very early 1990s, and I could see for myself most of the downtown was already hollowed out by that point already, and I imagine that's only accelerated since. I mean, there are global forces here. This is the competition of capitalism going on here. We had the period after World War II where we had Keynesianism, and that was acceptable because, one, the capitalists had the memory of the 1930s when there was all kinds of militant action, and they were really genuinely worried: was socialism, was communism going to sweep over the West, even the United States? So they're more willing to make concessions. Capitalism had a lot of places to expand. I had massive reproduction, reconstruction to do of Europe, of course, and much of East Asia was left devastated by World War II. And you had a great deal of pent-up consumer demand that was suppressed by the Great Depression of the 30s and the war years of the first half of the 1940s. That kind of ran its course as we get into the 1970s there. And from the capitalist point of view, they've now reached the limits of tolerating wage increases because now they can no longer increase wages but increase their profits even faster. So what do? They need to find ways of cutting costs. And so naturally they look at, okay, how can we cut down on what we pay in wages? So they start moving overseas. And as this develops its own momentum, then they use their leverage power. Obviously, capitalists have a real stranglehold on the political systems in countries like the United States. And they say, hey, look, this is what we need to do to survive. We need you to start loosening up the rules to make it easier for us to move materials back and forth between where we're opening up new production overseas and bring it back to the United States. And this, again, it feeds on itself. And this is where it's at. This is a product of capitalist competition. That's what neoliberalism. It's not a matter of somebody woke up one day and says, enough with Keynesianism. We shall now have neoliberalism. And no one can wake up one day and say, okay, enough of neoliberalism. We shall now go back to Keynesianism. It just doesn't work that way. You've got to change the entire dynamics of the global capitalist system, which obviously is an enormous task.
Let me talk about Carrier specifically. Carrier is the manufacturing plant. It manufactures heating furnaces and air conditioners in Indiana. And the big deal that Trump made was that as a consequence of his America First rhetoric and demanding that jobs come back, that Carrier was going to keep jobs in Indiana. Now, we had the president of the union, the Steelworkers Local, on this show way back when he said Trump is lying. That's not what's actually going to happen. And I want to read a couple sentences to remind people why this is a story. Even before he officially took, I'm looking at Truth Out. Even before he took office, President Trump flew to Indianapolis in December 2016 to trumpet a deal he had reached with air conditioning and heating furnace manufacturer Carrier. In return for Trump's pledge to reduce the corporate tax rate and reduce regulations, as well as $7 million in economic incentives, that's to the company, the company agreed to keep some jobs in the state rather than move them to a plant in Mexico as it had planned. While Trump bragged that he had saved 1,100 jobs, the truth was just 730 jobs were preserved at the Indianapolis plant. In reality, 550 from Indianapolis were still being moved to Mexico, and all 700 workers at the company's Huntington plant would still lose their jobs. Now, when you look at the fine print of Trump's deal with Carrier, giving the company a lot of money as an economic incentive, the fine print did not require the company to keep those jobs long term in Indiana. And guess what? Now they're not in Indiana. And the president, the new president of the union, is just saying, quote, he made promises that he didn't keep. And that is, laid off factory workers feel betrayed by Donald Trump. That's an important part of the story. You know, all the media talk, whether it's, you know, sort of East Coast, West Coast cities or other places, they never get the voice of working folks. I mean, that's a voice that's essentially just drowned out in this whole debate. There's always a surrogate speaking for workers, like Donald Trump is the surrogate or somebody else. But right now we have these factory workers in Indiana saying, quote, he, Donald Trump, made promises that he did not keep. That's important.
It goes a little deeper than that, too. Even before Trump was the apparent frontrunner in the Republican race, these same workers and their representatives in the United Steelworkers tried repeatedly to secure a meeting with then Governor Mike Pence, and Pence would have none of it. He would not meet with the union. He would not meet with the workers. He didn't want to talk about saving jobs.
The fine print of Trump's deal has now turned into reality. Roughly 340 more workers lost their jobs in July. The last round of layoffs means 250 more workers will clock in for their final shift today, despite Donald Trump's pledges. And then they quote in this article in Truthout, again, it's based on a story in these times, quote, Dwayne Oroskovich is one of them, quote, tomorrow will be the last time I clock in at 5 p.m. We'll get off at 3:30 in the morning, and that's the last time we'll clock out. Now, these workers, there's nobody looking out for these workers. The labor movement, Pete was talking about the trends within the global sort of post-World War II
right.
capitalist sort of reorganization of economies, deindustrialization, sending plants and factories offshore, lowering wages. But beneath it all, Pete, the fundamental reality is that the unions don't have the clout that they once had. I mean, that's really what's going on.
That's right.
Go ahead.
Yes, the unions definitely don't have any clout, partly because of all these external demands. If the union wants to take a hard line, say, in protecting their workers, the boss can just say, okay, fine, but we'll just move. Go ahead, but we'll just go ahead and move to China or Vietnam or Bangladesh or wherever. So the union is going to say, never mind. Not because there's something wrong or bad or defeatist necessarily with the union leader, but they have to deal with the cards that they have been dealt. I wouldn't want to completely free the union leaderships from any claim, because they also have had for many decades the so-called business union model, where they kind of see themselves as a little bit as partners, although very much junior partners with management, in trying to bring about whatever little bit of incremental improvements they can. Now it's more of a matter of, well, can we kind of like slow down the cuts and slow down the job losses? I think that's about where they're down to. And of course, union membership in the private sector is in the United States is something on the order of 7%. Union membership is mostly concentrated in the public sector now. And until at such time as working people are able to really organize themselves, whether it be in unions or some other kind of labor organization, this is just going to continue to go on and get worse and worse and just continue to deteriorate.
That's what we're looking at here. And it's not just in Indiana. The next thing we're going to read about is an almost identical story in the coal industry, let's say, in West Virginia, or something in eastern Pennsylvania, or something even in North Carolina related to the manufacturing of fabric. This is an ongoing story, and it's not going to go away. Unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. We were speaking with Pete Dolak, who's in New York. He's an activist and writer with Trade Justice New York Metro, and he focuses on human rights, social justice, and environmental and trade issues. Pete's also the author of It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. Pete, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.
Our pleasure. In the meantime, stay tuned. We will be right back. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Members of the Catalonian Parliament elected a separatist as speaker yesterday in their first meeting since the central government in Madrid dissolved the region's parliament. We're joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols, the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. Dick, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Brian. Hello, John.
Dick, the new speaker is a well-known separatist, but he's entering a situation where Carles Puigdemont, the Catalonian prime minister, is still in self-imposed exile. Most of the other leaders of the separatist movement are in jail. So what does this mean for the new speaker?
The new speaker has to tread a very fine line between two poles within the independence movement. There are those, mainly around Puigdemont, but not only around him, who want to use the majority, the pro-independence majority, to drive to restore the old government, the government that was removed by the intervention of Madrid back in October, which is a guarantee of a fresh conflict, because Madrid has said if they try to invest Puigdemont from exile, that is to say by video link from Brussels, then they will immediately appeal that to the Constitutional Court. That will suspend all parliamentary proceedings in Catalonia, the formation of a new government, and I would think practically guarantee new elections. Now, that prospect causes nerves for some people in the pro-independence camp. They think, can we really do this again? Can we really be sure of winning again? But other people say, if we don't do that, and when I say other people, I mean people closer around Puigdemont and Together for Catalonia, his formation, they say, if we don't do that, then what will happen is that Madrid will just turn us into a tame cat government. We won't be able to do anything because Madrid has already said, the Rajoy government has already said, that it will not restore Catalan control of finances, even though they will formally lift the intervention.
That's my second question right there. I don't want to butcher this poor man's name. It looks like Roger Torrent. I think it's Roger Torrent. The BBC is saying this is the first step toward reinstating local government, but that's not really true, is it? If the Catalonians cannot control their own finances, then that's not really independent government.
That's correct. What it is that the Madrid intervened financially into Catalonia, took over the finances before they formally applied Article 155, and then they said first these are separate things. These are separate interventions from the state into Catalonian government. Then, when the two things were operating simultaneously, said, oh, it's all the same thing. Now, given that they have said that they will abide by the decision of the voters, they have to suspend 155. They have to actually end 155 if a Catalan government forms. So now they've said, oh, no, these were always two separate decisions. So basically what you said is correct. You can have formal formal autonomy for the Catalan government, but absolute stranglehold on the finances. And that is the sort of scenario that's facing them if they're prepared to make too many concessions to Madrid. So Madrid will be very happy, when I say Madrid, I mean the Rajoy government. They will be very happy to have a formal Catalan government elected there, but powerless to actually do anything that's not completely within the framework of a standard regional government in Spain.
Dick Nichols is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. We're talking about Catalonia and the regional elections there. Dick Nichols, let me just ask you a big picture question, and you can go with it wherever you think fit. In the case of the UK, there was the Brexit vote, the vote to leave, to separate from the EU. And then as this process has unfolded with all of the complications and all of the, well, actually hardships that will be imposed on the UK as a consequence of the breakaway, things that were not anticipated by those who were voting to leave the EU. The idea now is if the people had a chance to vote once again, perhaps the referendum would come out differently. People think one thing about autonomy or separation, or in this case of Catalonia, independence, but then confronted with the hard realities of international relations, borders, control of airspace, finance, debt, you know, then it gets, you know, once you get into the weeds, it's the sort of the romantic element of independence sort of gives way to all of these myriad problems because it's all still trapped within the same world social, political, economic order from which you can't just, you know, escape. You can't become an island. How what's the public mood now? And are people sort of thinking these kind of thoughts as they reflect upon the situation? Or is it that the pitch between the heavy-handedness of the Rajoy government in Madrid versus the aspirations of the people to be the democratic controllers of their own destiny, that supersedes sort of the practical elements?
Well, that's a very good question, Brian. And of course, that's the question of questions, because the basic motor force of all of this is the commitment and morale of the Catalan pro-independence movement. If that starts to go, as many as unionists want it to go, and all their tactics are directed towards making this bubble, to breaking this bubble, then, of course, everything else goes with it. But at the moment, it's a very interesting situation. It's hard to give you a sort of nice, clear, black and white answer. But the Civil Guard raids on the ministries back in September, I think you remember those.
In the Civil Guards, just for our audience here, that's the central government.
That's the Spanish Civil Guard, which is the paramilitary police who live in barracks. Sorry, I should explain these things. But the Civil Guard raided government buildings in Barcelona and in Catalonia in the lead-up to the referendum as part of trying to stop the referendum. And they got their hands on a whole lot of information, which is now being used for prosecution of the people who were leading the organisation of the referendum, people in the government, but also collaborators with the government. Now, in this, a lot of stuff came out has already come out, which shows that the Catalan government was much less prepared, that it was pretending than it should have been, and that it was pretending that it was. And so there was a diary of one senior official where he said, well, we can't go on just telling people everything's okay when it isn't, some words to that effect, you know. Now, this has all come out, and people expected that that would lead to an enormous wave of demoralisation in the movement. And there was a lot of criticism and a lot of self-criticism about it, but it hasn't. And the first sign of that was, of course, the actual election result, because this all came out before the elections. And so at the moment, I think is happening, and this is just my take on it, and other people would disagree with this, but the moment what is happening is that the movement is maturing. The sort of happy days of we have a referendum, we can't have an agreed referendum, we have our own referendum, and then we have independence and a republic, and it's all going to be, you know, it's quick march to freedom and independence. That mood is gone. That illusion is gone. But it doesn't mean, what it means is that the movement is maturing. It's reflecting more about, well, what have we got to do? And it's reflecting on important questions like, what allies have we got in the rest of the Spanish state, which was never really confronted beforehand because of this illusion that you mentioned, that we could just sort of detach ourselves. Disconnect was the verb. We could just disconnect from Spain. Well, you can't just disconnect unless you've got a lot of forces supporting you. And it became very, very obvious. What, were there any Catalan army to defend the airports, et cetera, et cetera? No, there wasn't anything, which is why Puigdemont government was right, in my opinion, just to declare independence. And then they had to go because they, you know, the alternative was to call for resistance, which would have led to, you know, violence. Would have led to a situation where they didn't have the forces to defend themselves and to defend the new institutions. And so now what you've had is a retreat, a big retreat, and hence a big discussion about what do we have to do now to turn this around. But this has not led to a noticeable or yet visible demoralization of the movement.
Dick, we have about a minute left. I want to ask you about Puigdemont. He is still in self-imposed exile in Brussels. He's facing literally decades in prison in Spain if he returns to the country. Are there any kind of talks going on between Puigdemont and the government about a return or about a plea maybe or no plea and the ability to go back to Catalonia?
Not that I know of. I mean, I'd be surprised if there weren't feelers being, you know, top secret feelers going back and forth. But the politics of the situation here is that Madrid and the PP cannot afford to abandon their hard line because they're now under threat at the level of the Spanish state for the first time ever from the right. They have a competitor in the form of Citizens. And Citizens' line on Catalonia and on the Spanish state is the source of all problems in the Spanish state is nationalism. So you've just got to get rid of it. So even if the PP wanted to negotiate a bit more with Puigdemont or with the independentists in Catalonia, it can't do it because of its own survival needs.
Right. That's, you know, that's really the most difficult part of this entire thing. It's you're damned if you do or damned if you don't. And I said this last week, Brian, it's one of these situations where the irresistible force meets the immovable object. And there doesn't seem to be any quick way to set this thing aside.
Intractable.
There is no quick way. It's a grinding trench warfare. And it's a matter of maintaining on this side, on the, you know, people who are for supporting the democratic right of self-determination of the Catalans, it's a matter of maintaining morale, not making stupid mistakes, and keeping the pressure up.
That's it. That's it right there. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, too. We were joined from Barcelona by Dick Nichols. Dick is the correspondent for Spain and Catalonia for Green Left Weekly. Dick, thanks for joining us. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
More than 120 prisoners took control of a French prison outside Paris in response to a demonstration by hundreds of prison guards a day earlier, during which the guards burned tires and wooden pallets in protest against a rise in inmate violence, insufficient staff, and a lack of resources to deal with dangerous jihadists they have been tasked with jailing. We're joined from Paris by Sputnik correspondent and news analyst Ksenia Kozlitina. Ksenia, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Hello.
This sounds like role reversal to me. Having spent 2 years in prison myself, I can't imagine the guards burning pallets and tires and demanding changes. It's usually the prisoners that want to take over the prison.
It's France, though. It's France.
Yeah, but I mean, it's France. It's a lot in the mentality. It's not the first time it's happening. You know how French people are. Whatever they have a problem, they're going to go and protest.
But these seem like real problems, though, real issues that the guards have. Are these legitimate issues?
Yeah, totally they are. As you might know, on 11th of January, three prison guards had been attacked by, they say, like, they don't precise if it's knife or scissors, but like attacked by an armor, by an inmate. Basically, in jail in Pas-de-Calais, which is not that far from Paris. So, they are shocked and they're really stressed. They have horrible work conditions. They don't stop complaining. That's not the first prison riot that I'm doing. The first one I've done was last spring, and I was really impressed by how tough those guys are and by how you can see that they really do have a problem. They really do complain. They talk to media even openly because they want to be heard, because you can feel them feeling desperate. Do you know what I mean? And they wouldn't stop complaining about how they're not getting paid enough and how, I mean, I heard about their salaries. They're really not big at all. And by the working conditions, and like, I mean, you can see they're really tough people. And you can see it through the riots as well, because the riots are really impressive and they are tough and they're really serious. It gets like really violent, it gets dangerous. And although they do work for the government too, so it shows a little bit of the show from the both sides, because you would say why, like they would shout out loud being like, well, we served with you. We both work from the government, but now what, the police gonna fire tear gas at us? Do you know what I mean? So it, like, at first it seems like a little bit of a show. But then as soon as you start talking to them and they really do explain what's bothering them and they do explain why they wouldn't stop protesting, then you do start understanding, but their work conditions are really not great. And they talking, I heard numbers, I'm just going to check really quickly, in between 4,000 and 5,000 people, like workers, aggressed per year. I don't know if it's the right word, but they have problems. Like inmates would, you know, try and stab them or try and attack them. So in between 4,000 and 5,000 workers per year.
Xenia, let me ask you, what about this protest seems to have two parts to it, though, initiated by prison guards and prison personnel, but the prisoners are now also protesting. What are the conditions for the prisoners?
All right. Well, so the conditions for the prisoners are real bad, obviously, as well. I haven't seen it personally. I haven't been to jail, not yet. But initially, it started with the prison guards protesting, right? So it's been 4 days now. They would build the barricades around the prisons. They would burn them. They were just the police forces, etc. Now, this morning, since 6 in the morning, they started building barricades, protesting, and so they already don't have enough of prison guards to go work. And because half of them are so busy protesting, there wasn't enough people in the jail. So they announced no guests today in prisons, no visitors. So they announced shorter walks for inmates today. And that's what provoked the inmates trying to protest too. Because they were like, well, what do we care that prison guards are not happy with their job? We want our walks. We want, you know, the regular schedule. We want visitors to come. And they, because prison guards are protesting, it kind of provoked the inmates to try and protest too. I wouldn't say that was crazy. I heard they were refusing to go back from their walk because the timing of their walk was reduced due to the protests of the guards.
And this is spreading to other prisons around France. Is that correct?
Oh, it's all over. It's not just one prison. We're not talking one prison. The prison I've been this morning, the prison I've been Monday, is called Fleury. It's the biggest prison in Europe, and it's obviously the biggest one in France. And they keeping like the most dangerous jihadists there. Like, it's a really serious prison. And that's the prison where it happened with inmates. But the guards protest all over France. That's massive. Inmates were only protesting, like trying to protest in this Fleury prison, which is the biggest one in France.
And that kind of thing happens all the time. I mean, prisoners complain all the time. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, legitimate complaints, but this is unusual in that the guards have taken to the streets. The guards nationally have engaged their union to lead these protests. This is actually a big deal. Now, in the United States, the way these things normally work out is everybody will sit down at a table, everybody will make concessions, and then they go back to their normal business. Do you see that happening in this case?
Well, they're like, well, first of all, it's France again. Like, they just say that's their mentality. That's the way they're trying to be heard. I have a feeling that the government will not hear them unless they burn, you know, three barricades before the jail. Then they did sit at the table. They were received by the ministry, the three guards that had been attacked. And from what I know, from the information from the people I spoke to at the protest, they were not received as they were expecting to, and they're not at all getting what they were hoping to get. And if they even getting anything from the government for themselves, it doesn't mean that the other guards will have a better life. Obviously, no, this is a problem. This, I don't know if it's usual or unusual. I'm kind of used to people protesting all the time in France. but it is really impressive, and it looks really serious, to be fair. And like, from now, today was this protest in the morning, and to say that the police was acting really violent towards the prisoners, while it's the same, it's the government against the government, you know, they work for the same system, but it clashed pretty badly. And now they are announcing this to be continued, and they're announcing to get more violent, and they're announcing to resist harder against the police. So now that, like, for me, it's escalating into a real crisis.
This is something that certainly bears watching. You know, it's kind of a fun story for a moment, and then you realize that it's actually an important issue. We were joined from Paris by Sputnik correspondent and news analyst Ksenia Kozlitina. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking that page on Facebook. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.